Hello and welcome. Thank you for calling into Cigna's Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner and I'm a care manager for the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you will be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After this brief survey, you will be able to ask questions about today's seminar. A handout for the seminar is available online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side, click on Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Then click on Eating Disorder Education and Resources. And finally, click on Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen by today's date, you will find today's handout. Again, visit us at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side, you will click on Visit Our Education and Resource Center, then click on Eating Disorder Education and Resources, and then click on Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen by today's date, you will find today's handout. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Melanie Smith. She's the program manager for the Renfrew Center. Today she'll be sharing her presentation on Expanding Your Toolbox, Coping Skills in Eating Disorder Recovery. Melanie?
Hi, everyone. Thank you for tuning in and logging on today. Today I'm going to be covering a wide variety of topics that I'm hoping will be helpful to you. I know the audience will be made up not only of those who are struggling with an eating disorder or who have struggled with an eating disorder in the past, but also family and friends of those who are struggling. So I'm hoping that everyone will be able to benefit in some way, and just know that some of the information may be directed towards individuals that are struggling, and others might be directed towards caregivers. So if you move on to the first slide, or I guess the second slide, actually, go over what we're going to be talking about today. The basic principles of relapse prevention and how we would apply those principles on a case-by-case basis. The importance of family and primary support systems in recovery. We're going to look at the difference between a slip versus a relapse. Then we're going to also follow up with letting you know then what do you do, you know, in real life when relapse does happen. And finally, we're going to talk a lot about coping skills that actually work. And I say that because, you know, you can find lists of hundreds of different coping skills on the Internet. Not everyone works for each person. So we're going to talk a little bit about ones that we know or have been told have been successful. So if you move on to the next slide. You know, if you're talking about recovery, you have to also talk about relapse prevention. So the substance abuse field actually has a lot to offer when looking at creating an effective relapse prevention plan. The concepts we're going to review here that are listed on the screen were developed by Terence Gorski and the Synapse Group. And again, these are substance abuse clinicians. And the model's been used with a lot of success for the past 20-plus years. So when someone out there is doing something good, we certainly like to borrow from it and use it. And this again, has shown to be pretty effective. So a relapse prevention plan really should be very comprehensive, so that's why we have a lot of these different things on this slide here, and I'm going to talk about each one a little bit. But it really should be unique to the individual. That's kind of what I want to underline. And the groundwork really needs to be laid before someone finishes up their treatment for the plan to be successful. It's not going to be that helpful to develop a relapse prevention plan after someone has already, you know, exited treatment at whatever level of treatment they're getting. So it's really important to start looking at this early on. And also when developing a relapse prevention plan, it's important that all of these components that we're about to talk about in detail are accounted for. I mean, really, you can't just buy a book that gives you the step-by-step, you know, instructions on how to do recovery. There is no one book that has that that's going to tell you individually in your life how to do recovery. So it really is a process, and that's why we use this model. So if you go to the next slide, the first concept that's important to think about in relapse prevention is self-regulation. So really, to be self-regulated, a person needs to be stabilized physically, psychologically, and socially. The cornerstone of this concept in the traditional substance abuse application is abstinence and maintaining abstinence despite withdrawal. Now, with eating disorders, that's obviously a little bit complicated to define really what abstinence is. We can talk about that a little bit more. But with eating disorders, really the focus needs to first and foremost be on determining and defining what is within the healthy range. And really the treatment professionals are the ones who should be setting what the standards are as far as what is the healthy range, because there's a lot of gray area in that. And then, you know, secondly, regulating eating behaviors into that healthy range. So it's figuring out what the range is and regulating behaviors into that range. And the next slide, the concept to be talking about is integration. So it's really important to take a self-assessment and identify what some of the major kind of life problems are. What is the symptom history? How far does it go back? What types of symptoms are you struggling with? Because no two people with an eating disorder have the exact same kind of symptom picture. And also it's important to think about the recovery relapse history, because a lot of times people will have, you know, marked periods of time where they really are in recovery and doing well, and then a slip or relapse may occur and the cycle kind of starts over again. So it's important to examine that and to note any previous warning signs of a relapse that might have been ignored, because you really want to pay attention to that the next time it comes around. So you really need to look at the picture, big picture, and figure out how, you know, you kind of got to where you are. On the next slide, understanding and self-knowledge. I mean, understanding refers to you being educated about addiction, recovery, and relapse prevention. So psychoeducation is very important, and you're doing it right now. So bravo, you've already done one step of the relapse prevention plan by, you know, logging on today and getting educated about relapse prevention and about coping skills. So good job on that. Self-knowledge, you as an individual really need to be able to recognize your own relapse warning signs, or what we might call red flags. So that could be irrational thoughts, intense feelings, either positive or negative, but usually negative, or any other self-destructive behaviors. And again, these are going to be different for each person, so I can't just give you a blanket list that's going to apply to everyone. So that's why this has to be really individualized. On the next slide, coping skills, and we're going to get into this much more later into the presentation, but really, you know, the idea of having coping skills is being able to utilize a specific intervention or a tactic or a tool, whatever you want to call it, to prevent a relapse situation. So, you know, it's one thing to know the warning signs and identify those red flags, but it's not really helpful unless you have the skills to kind of back it up and the skills to deal with it when you come up with that warning sign. So when a situation arises that triggers the red flag, you know, you need to know what the next course of action needs to be, and I can give you some examples of good courses of action later in the presentation. Moving on, change. Not only being committed to making a change, but actually making the behavioral change. So it's one thing to talk the talk, it's another to walk the walk. So the first step really needs to be in any recovery situation, whether it's from drugs, alcohol, eating disorder, needs to be removing yourself from a dangerous or triggering situation or anything that's toxic to recovery. We can't change everything in our environment. We can't change everything about the people that are in our lives. But if there are things that we can change, things that could lead us down the road to relapse, then certainly we, by all means, we need to make a commitment to do that, even when it's uncomfortable or inconvenient. Moving on to the next slide, awareness. Creating a daily inventory is a really excellent tool for relapse prevention. We use it a lot in treatment and also recommend it for after treatment. So inventories really can be used to help plan the day ahead. And then at the end of the day, you can look back and review the progress that you made, the struggles that you had. And if you're in an outpatient setting, this is a really useful tool to share with your outpatient therapist. So, you know, some of the things that you would like to put on your daily inventory are, you know, what are you struggling with? What symptoms did you engage in? What situations triggered those? Do you feel them more at certain times of the day? Some people tend to struggle more at night. Others not, you know, might struggle more at work. So it's helpful to identify a pattern and be able to then, you know, make a plan and do something about it. Moving on to the next slide. You know, significant others are so important. Utilizing support from those around you really is essential. I don't know of anyone who has successfully really done recovery in isolation. I haven't seen it in my experience. It goes without saying that the more, you know, emotionally and psychologically healthy the significant others are, the more likely they are to be helpful to you. But in reality, the healthy, supportive individuals may not be from your family, your immediate family. It could be, you know, coworkers, friends, people you meet in support groups. It could be people you've met in treatment, and others in recovery who kind of know where you've been. So it can come from lots of sources. So an important thing is to kind of just be open to it and let other people in. Moving on, the maintenance. The concept of maintenance. I mean, the model really recommends that the relapse prevention plan is regularly updated during the first 3 years of recovery, because recovery really is a long-term process. So this particular group that put this model together that we're talking about, they actually have a very specific timeline that I like to follow, and I do find it to be a helpful guideline. So they recommend that you look at it like once per month for the first 3 months, because that's when kind of that's the most tenuous time or the most tricky time when you're first kind of really embarking on recovery, maybe new coming out of treatment or something like that. Then once every third month for the remainder of the first year, and then every 6 months for the next 2 years. So again, it's a 3-year long process, and really, you know, we recommend, you know, long-term lower level of care, outpatient treatment on some, in some form or fashion, for quite a deal of time, because most people have suffered with their eating disorders for quite a long time before they actually get treatment. So we think the follow-up care is essential. So another thing to remember about this is that, you know, relapses, the most relapses occur within the first 6 months of recovery. So it's not always easy to accurately predict what situations would have caused a relapse during your inpatient treatment stay if you do ever need inpatient treatment. So that's why the ongoing treatment is really important part of relapse prevention. So, and, you know, coming from me being a professional that works in a residential treatment program, you know, even the most effective residential program in isolation with no follow-up treatment will not interrupt a chronic relapse cycle. I mean, you could have the best treatment in the world, but if you're not doing any follow-up and getting support and maintaining that relapse prevention plan, long-term it's really not going to be very effective. So, you know, the outpatient levels are extremely important. So, moving on, so why not use the model as it is? Everything I just talked about sounded pretty good, and I think that these are things we should be using, but we can't use it in its exact form. Really, the primary thing is that, you know, the primary treatment goal in a substance abuse application is abstinence. And, you know, once you have abstinence, a lot of the other stuff falls into place. Well, it's really hard to identify what abstinence is, and, you know, really live that in its truest form. It doesn't really work with eating disorders when your symptoms are things that you can't necessarily abstain from. So, you know, this can be challenging, because a lot of times people who struggle with eating disorders operate under what we call black and white thinking, kind of seeing things in extreme as either a yes or a no. So, you know, clinicians really are challenged to, you know, help you kind of see the shades of gray. So we're going to talk about that a little bit more on the next slide. So, you know, the complicating factors that contribute to the fact that abstinence in and of itself is not an option. So if you're looking at the symptom of restriction, you know, you want to look at, you know, what's the difference between normal portion control and normal healthy weight maintenance versus restriction. I mean, the concept of dieting being the key to wellness is all around us. You can't turn on the radio or the TV without, you know, the newest diet plan telling you that your life is going to be infinitely better because you did it. So, I mean, it's difficult to kind of tease that out. And really, you know, there are obviously very major benefits to moderation and portion control. I mean, those are valid things. So where do you draw the line? What is too much, you know, regulation of your eating behaviors? With purging, a lot of times it's hard to know, you know, is this, if you did purge, was it an anxiety reaction that created that? Was it intentional? It's sometimes difficult to tease out. With exercise, every individual person can benefit from healthy exercise. We know that for preventative health reasons that we should all be exercising a moderate amount. But how do you know where to draw the line? You know, can you rely on your personal trainer at the gym? I would think in many cases you cannot, because personal trainers don't get a lot of education and training on how to appropriately deal with someone who has an eating disorder. Your nutritional needs may be different from their typical clients, and your goals should be different from someone who's trying to win a bodybuilding competition. I wouldn't recommend that for someone recovering from eating disorder getting in that kind of activity. Emotional eating, to me, seems the trickiest So, you know, say, for example, it's your birthday. Is it really that big of a deal to have an extra piece of cake and ice cream because you're celebrating? Or it's the holidays, it's Thanksgiving, and your family tradition is to graze on snacks all day and enjoy a four-course meal, and you've got six side items and four varieties of dessert. You know, is this behavior pathological, or is it something that just kind of falls on more of the outer limits of normal? So that's important to kind of tease out. And it's not always easy to have, you know, one answer. So that's what makes it a little bit more complicated and why, again, a plan needs to be specific to the individual. So if you look at the next slide, which is slide number 14, you know, I think it's important that, you know, you try to find the balance because women that struggle with eating disorders, particularly anorexia, often have a key characteristic of them as perfectionism. And while some level of perfectionism can be adaptive and it can promote success in careers or academics, perfectionism also can have some negative kind of parts to it. So the same perfectionism that fuels some eating disorder thoughts can also make recovery more challenging. So if someone feels like they need to do everything right and be the best, that can lead to a couple problems. So some problems that might come up from that would be maybe someone who tries to be the perfect patient and they wear a mask in therapy and try to do all the right things and say all the right things but hasn't really internalized the changes that need to be made. Or you know, the best example would be just in general. If you hold yourself to a unrealistically high standard and expect everything to be perfect, then you're kind of setting yourself up to be disappointed or feel like a failure if you have unrealistically high expectations of yourself. So that perfectionism certainly can make recovery more challenging. Some key things that are certainly important as part of your relapse prevention plan would be a multidisciplinary treatment team. So of the disciplines that would be important, but everyone, you know, might have a different kind of approach on this, but the kind of key players that you really should have would be a therapist. And a therapist can be, you know, from several different fields or orientations. So it could be a licensed psychologist, a licensed clinical social worker, licensed mental health counselor, licensed marriage and family therapist. If you notice me saying licensed over and over again, I do think that that is important. Because that shows you that that person has, you know, the necessary training and falls under certain standards and guidelines. So I think that that's important. But there's no one particular that's going to be better, per se, for your individual needs. But I think that piece is important. Nutritional guidance is a must. Oftentimes what we hear when people are leaving treatment is that they're like, okay, well, I'm going to see my therapist and, you know, I'm going to have my mom help me watch what my weight's doing at home, so I don't need a nutritionist. My therapist can guide me. That's really not advisable. A nutritionist has so much more specialized training. It really is going to be helpful because the meal plan that one person that you might have now may be different, you know, 3 months from now based on what your medical needs are and your nutritional needs are. So it's really important to follow up with a nutritionist as well. Psychiatry and medical monitoring will also be important for a lot of people. Not for everyone. It kind of depends. But, you know, ultimately, you know, you can talk to your therapist about whether or not they think that that's important or your primary care physician. And a family therapist is also a really good addition. But really, ultimately, you want to think of the treatment team as an extension of the primary support system and as absolutely necessary as far as long-term recovery. Moving on to the next slide, slide 16, family and primary support. So I've said it before and I'll say it a couple more times that recovery does not occur in isolation. You know, and it's important to remember that those who are struggling with eating disorders are not really the only ones who are struggling or suffering. It really impacts the whole family. So it's essential that the family and the support system really be involved in supporting the recovery as well. I would recommend that you sign a release of information or an authorization form so that family, the immediate family members that are going to be supporting you do have, you know, access to talk to the therapist. And it's not unlimited access, and you and your family and your therapist can talk about what the parameters of that are. But I think it's really helpful because sometimes when you need the extra support, it's really important that your family be able to be there for you in that. So it does involve giving up some control, which can be hard, but I think it is in your best interest in the long run. And it doesn't have to be, you know, your Uncle Bob and your Aunt Sally and people who aren't really in your life, but those really key, important people that are really helping you in recovery, I think that is a helpful thing. Also, You know, it's good to have a treatment contract that can apply to the whole family, and, you know, the individual, the therapist, and the family should be involved in creating that contract, because, again, it's going to be different for every person. So, you know, there would be certain stipulations or obligation that the, you know, the individual or the identified client is responsible for, but the family, the support system will also have some obligations. So an example of an item that you might want to put on a treatment contract might be, Mom and Dad agree that no food, weight, or body talk be in the home, as they understand that that is triggering to Jane. We'll call her Jane. So things that are specific, things to say and not say, or how to be supportive and how not to be supportive. And we'll talk a little bit more about contracting a little bit later, but those are just some examples. So going to the next slide, here are some ways to provide support. Educate yourself. You're doing it right now. Again, bravo for sticking on the line. So oftentimes people assume that eating disorders are about food and weight, but we know that this is not true. And I actually, on the very, very last slide of the presentation, I have a couple of books on there that I've recommended as readings. They're helpful for individuals and also for family and friends. So I would recommend that you take a look at some of those. So, you know, becoming an educated advocate is really important. Participating in family therapy, you know, a therapist can be a great source of information and can provide guidance on how to interact with each other and how, as a caregiver, you can support your loved one. I would recommend to family members or spouses or people who are really in the thick of it with someone else in their recovery to consider getting into your own support group. There are family and friends support groups out there. They aren't always easy to find, but they are out there. So Google searches can find all kinds of neat stuff if you're really looking. So I would recommend that. Or also consider getting into your own therapy because being, you know, going alongside someone who's been struggling for a really long time certainly can take an impact on your own kind of well-being. So I would definitely recommend that if you feel that that is needed. Let's see. Also with support groups I mentioned, you know, Google is a great tool, but there are some specific websites that are really good and organizations that offer support groups to individuals and to families. NEDA, N-E-D-A, the National Eating Disorders Association, their website has a list of resources that are helpful, and also ANAD, A-N-A-D. I believe that's anad.org. They also have a list of support groups in the area. You know, speaking out about diet industry messages and challenging stereotypes, this is something, again, you can't go to the supermarket aisle and not find, you know, five magazines that tell you how that celebrity lost 30 pounds in 30 days or, you know, touting the latest, you know, diet that's the new trend. So it's important to kind of point out when you see those things, like, that is not reality. That is not what's helpful to you. So really challenging those stereotypes, or like taking note of the fact that Photoshop is used on the cover of most every magazine and that real women don't look like that. It's hard to kind of remember that sometimes, and I think that that can be very impactful over time. And it's important to remain actively involved. And again, we talked about, you know, participating in family therapy, being part of the family contract. I think that's essential. So you might want to know more specifically what to do as a family member. You might want to know what to do and what not to do. So as far as what to do, it's really important to ask, how can I support you? Because, again, I can't give you a book and tell you this is how you support your loved one specifically. They need to tell you. Some people like it when you might give them a hug, others might not. So you need to ask them specifically, what is it that I can do to support you? It's good to point out the positive qualities about someone that are not appearance-based, and I think we're so hardwired to comment on when someone looks nice or their hair is pretty or I think you look beautiful. I think we're hardwired to do that, and we need to try our best, especially when with someone who's working in recovery, to not be so focused on appearance. You know, comment on health and energy versus a physical appearance. So, you know, you might want to say something like, you look happy. That might be more appropriate and showing, you know, recognition of an improved quality of life, and you're not focusing on the body shape or size. So it can be tricky, but you'd want to try to start thinking in that way. It's important to be a good role model and, you know, show balanced living and balanced healthy eating and, you know, a moderate exercise level and not really doing things to the extreme yourself. Again, seeking help from a professional as far as, you know, bringing someone in to help your loved one in their recovery if they don't already have, you know, a treatment team. Remain focused on the recovery and be positive. You kind of have to be to kind of keep pushing forward because it can be very challenging at times. So on the other flip side, on the next slide, number 19, what not to do. These are some important what not to do. So no food, weight, or body talk. So that is hard to do because, again, we're hardwired to comment on what we're eating and how much we think, how many calories are in it, and I think that this, you know, ice cream is going to go straight to my thighs. We need to really work as a society, but particularly those of us who are wanting to support people with eating disorders, that is not helpful. So it's really important not to spend time talking about that, not to ask your loved one how much she weighs, how much weight she gained, how much weight she lost, at least not at a meal, and not, it has to be during an appropriate time, like during a family session time. So please be aware of that. You know, don't change your entire family's eating patterns to accommodate the eating disorder. So if someone's eating disorder indicates that they now no longer eat meat and they no longer eat carbs or fats, don't change your family's whole meal pattern to accommodate the eating disorder. That's not helpful in recovery. That's enabling. So that's something to be mindful of. Don't let the eating disorder consume you. And I'm talking to you as family members out there. You know, sometimes you need to take a break. You need to make it a priority to spend quality time with your family, with friends. You know, take a vacation. Your life has to go on. Because, again, you know, the impact that your loved one's struggles can have on you can be very significant. And don't blame yourself. You may be asking yourself, what could I have done to prevent this? Or, you know, I must have done something wrong for this to happen to my wife or to my daughter. But the truth is that there is no one cause for an eating disorder. All the research in the world will tell you that. There is no one cause. Every family makes mistakes and has some level of dysfunction. But the family did not create this problem, so please don't bear that burden. So it's really important to examine your interactions with your loved one and see if there's something that may be contributing to the problem. An example like that would be emotional abuse. Then those things certainly need to be addressed. But again, this is why family therapy is very important and will be helpful. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about mealtime tips because, you know, the meal can be very stressful and anxiety-provoking for someone with an eating disorder. So, you know, I really recommend planning ahead and finding out before you actually sit down to the meal which topics the individual finds triggering or difficult, so which are okay and which are not okay. So have a pre-planned list of that and of safe topics, you know, what things are safe and okay to talk about at the meal. And some people find it helpful to play games during the meal because it helps ease some of the tension and keeps them from kind of being in their head, maybe calculating the calories or perseverating over, you know, the nutritional content of the food. So, you know, those are some good tips. As a family member, you can offer support. But again, find out from the person ahead of time, do you want me to offer support to you during the meal or do you want me to follow up with you after we've left the table and ask you then? Because that might feel a little bit safer and less controlling. But it's always good to check in after the meal if you're not sure. So let's talk a little bit about slips and relapses and what's the difference, because sometimes it can be hard to tell the difference. A slip really is the presence of an eating disorder symptom that occurs with mild frequency, so it's not happening very often. But the most important piece is this second part where it says it's followed by getting back on track with the recovery plan. So a slip is expected. One slip, please don't freak out by one slip. It happens. And really, it's very good practice for using those coping skills and making sure that you've got those kind of refined and ready to go because slips happen. None of us are perfect. Again, we're trying to challenge perfectionism and not be perfectionists because that's not helpful. So, you know, an example of what a slip might be would be restricting a fat or a carb or something like that during lunch one time, having one binge, over-exercising one or two times a week, or even skipping a therapy appointment or a nutrition appointment. But really, the most important thing to remember is it's a time-limited event, and it doesn't recur. A relapse, on the other hand, is when the presence of symptoms occur frequently or daily. So binging and purging daily, restricting most meals, exercising to the point of exhaustion. Those are indicators of a full-blown relapse, and it certainly requires more intervention. So if you move on to the next slide, slide 23, I give you some specific ideas of what to do in case of a slip. So again, the one-time kind of slip-up. I would definitely recommend calling your therapist to make an appointment earlier. If you don't, you know, plan to see your therapist until next Wednesday, then maybe you could call and see and get your appointment moved to tomorrow. You know, to shorten the amount of time between appointments. It's really important to talk about what might have caused the slip and to talk about it not only with your therapist but also with your family and the people that support you. You know, don't hide it. Don't do this, again, in isolation. You don't have to do recovery in isolation. You know, pull out your list of identified coping skills and explore new ones, and we'll get to some examples of coping skills in a minute. And use it as a teachable moment. This is extremely important. So if you really process it well and you're able to get back on track, then the slip can really be a big confidence builder, because the next time you come up to a slip, you know what, this has happened before, I was able to do X, Y, or Z coping skill, and I got back on track, and it wasn't the end of the world, so I can do it again. And, you know, kind of going on that same line, remember that a slip does not destine someone to relapse, so do not panic and then, you know, assume that everything's gone downhill after that. So moving on to the next slide, in a more severe case when someone has fallen into a full-blown relapse, it really is important to seek medical attention because we know that eating disorders certainly have significant medical and psychological complications. So it's really important to seek medical attention, to reach out for support. I think you probably heard me say that a lot, and I'm going to say it some more. Work with a therapist to establish a treatment contract if you don't already have one, or make adjustments to the treatment contract. A good example of one that is used on an outpatient basis would be one item of the contract might say, if I'm not able to maintain my weight above 90%, or, you know, you can determine what percentage that is, I will seek readmission to a higher level of care, meaning that whatever level of care you're in at that time probably is not quite enough. But that's just an example. And again, consider seeking a higher level of care if your treatment team, if your doctors and your therapist are recommending that, then it's something to consider. So, you know, some guidelines about when a higher level care might be necessary is if, you know, you go get your labs done and, you know, your weight's not seeming to be within the range that it needs to be, your lab values are off, or are there any other medical conditions that need more intervention? That's an indicator. If the behaviors continue to escalate, so it might have started with restricting, you know, one time a day, and then it started to get more progressive until you're only eating, you know, certain things at certain times, and it's very restrictive. So an escalation is a good indicator that you need a higher level of care. Or if you're engaging in any sort of high-risk behavior that has the potential to harm for yourself or others, that is an absolute 100% yes. You need to seek a higher level of care. So how do you go about doing that? Ask a therapist for recommendation. Your therapist knows you well and should know the field well, so they can give you some recommendations on what they think is helpful. Once you have those recommendations, you can contact the providers and schedule an assessment, and they'll be able to help you figure out whether or not intensive outpatient or day treatment or even inpatient treatment is going to be the best course of action for you. And, you know, it's normal to feel ambivalent and unsure if you really want to pursue going to a higher level of care, because that certainly takes a lot of courage and certainly a lot of sacrifice as well, as far as sacrificing your time and energy and finances and all of those things. So, you know, really this is, again, another time where your support system is important. Ask for support. Ask for support from your friends, from your family, from your treatment team, and ask them to hold you accountable, because that will be helpful. Okay, so I promised coping skills that would actually work. So let's talk about those a little bit more. So on slide number 27, you know, it's important to think about, because eating disorder treatment works to really change and modify your current method of coping, which would be eating disorder, which, you know, is the most maladaptive, one of the most maladaptive coping skills I know, you really need to learn new skills. So that you're less vulnerable to relapse. So, you know, finding new coping skills might be difficult, because it's really easy to want the quick fix or an immediate gratification. But the development of an alternative healthy coping skill can take time, but it's important. So you'll need to practice those skills to find out, you know, what works best for you. So it's important to know that not every skill works for every single person. So I may give some examples that may not be helpful to you at all. I may give others that's going to be your go-to skill anytime you're struggling, so it kind of just depends. And not every skill will be helpful for every situation, so certain skills like journaling might be helpful in some situations, but in other more intense situations where you're struggling more, it may not be as helpful. But the most important thing is that, again, the skill should be adaptive. So the skill should not create a different problem in an effort to avoid that, you know, unpleasant thought or, you know, that difficult time. So, you know, a maladaptive coping behavior would be to use drugs to avoid urges to binge eat. That would not be helpful because that's then creating yet another problem. You're not binge eating, but then you're, you know, abusing drugs. So the following slides, we're going to talk about some coping skills that we teach and we use in treatment at the Renfrew Center. So all these ideas that I'm going to share have been used with success by someone with an eating disorder. One that I really like is developing a goals and value statement. It's kind of a good place to start. You know, you really want to explore, who am I? You know, what's important to me? What is my identity without my eating disorder? What can I be? And I just want to point out a lot of the, or all of the artwork is original artwork by women who were residents at the Renfrew Center in Florida. So I just wanted to brag a little bit about some of our great artwork. If you go on to the next slide, slide 29, creative outlets are very helpful for a lot of people, art in particular. Something to remember about when using art as a coping skill is that the final product does not have to be perfect. Remember, we're challenging perfectionism. You know, so you can color with crayons. It doesn't have to be an elaborate, beautiful oil painting. It can be coloring with crayons in a coloring book. You know, it's really about the process and about what that process means to you and how you feel when you're doing it. Some specific ideas would be a coping skills box. You can create a box, maybe like get one of those inexpensive pencil boxes or something that you might have used when you were in elementary school, and you could collage pictures on the outside of it that might be affirming or helpful. And then on the inside, put things in it that are part of your coping skills. So some people in times of stress really like to use stress balls. You could put a stress ball in there. You could put silly putty in there. People like to pull and squeeze on silly buddy. It kind of does the same thing that a stress ball might do. You might want to put that in there. Or if there's a particular poem or article or something that you find inspiring or helpful, or pictures, you can put those inside of your box so that whenever you're having a hard time, you can pull out your box. It's a very tangible product that can be helpful. And again, the process of creating it can be therapeutic in and of itself. A containment box kind of does the opposite of a coping skills box. It's really a place to contain those negative thoughts or negative memories. So if you struggle with negative thoughts about yourself and negative memories, those are things that you could write down or, again, collage or put images of and put it in a box. And the idea is really being able to close the box and put it away on the shelf, taking those negative thoughts or those negative experiences and putting them away and not having to deal with them in the present moment, because sometimes we're just not able to deal with those, and you don't have to every moment of every day. So that's one that we find really helpful. And again, other ideas would be painting, drawing, or collage. Music is very helpful for a lot of people. You know, writing original music is similar to, you know, writing poetry, but writing, you know, lyrics that are meaningful to you and meaningful to your recovery. A lot of people like to have an iPod playlist that has uplifting songs and use that throughout your day while you're driving in your car, while you're going about your day. Physical activity. Now, again, with physical activity, we have to be careful and be mindful of the moderation key of it. But dance and movement therapy has been shown to be very helpful and effective for many people with eating disorders. So I would recommend that you look into that and see if there are any dance and movement therapists or groups in your area that you could participate in. We find yoga to be very helpful as far as the breathing components of it, relaxation. We wouldn't recommend the hot yoga. I don't know the official technical name of it, but if you're going into a room where they're turning up the thermostat to over 100 degrees, that's not going to be helpful to someone who's working on moderation. That's a little bit extreme, so we wouldn't recommend that, but other more traditional forms of yoga. Stretching is helpful, taking short walks outside, taking your dog for a walk. You know, with any movement or exercise, again, don't forget the moderation. So really it's important to get approval from your nutritionist or your primary care physician before you start any sort of exercise regimen. So it would not be helpful if you have a history of excessive exercise and your primary coping skill is running 5 miles. That's maladaptive and could, again, be a very, very slippery slope. So you want to always consult with a treatment professional. Moving on to slide 31, writing exercises. A couple of writing exercises that people have done that they find helpful would be writing a goodbye letter to your eating disorder. You can talk to your eating disorder almost as if it's another person. because, you know, we want you to remember that your eating disorder is not you. You are not defined by it. It is not you. It is it's a part of you that you can be free of if you choose to. So writing a good bi-letter is very helpful as far as finding closure and separating yourself. Writing in the third person is also a helpful tactic. And writing down everything you're thankful for, kind of like you might do sometimes in your family on Thanksgiving, talking about what you're thankful for that year. You know, write down everything you're thankful for. It's easy to kind of get bogged down in the negative, and we forget about all those other really great things that we might take for granted. So that can be a really nice exercise. Write an inspirational quote over and over again, or use it as inspiration for a journal entry. You know, if you find come across a really good quote that you like, you know, use that as a jumping off point and journal around that. Post affirmations around the house. Post-it notes are a great thing. Put them on the fridge. Put them on your bathroom mirror. Have them around in places that can kind of remind you throughout the day. And also, again, you have to use your best judgment on this, but using message boards or chat rooms on pro recovery sites. And pro is in capital letters because not every site out there about eating disorders are pro recovery. So you need to be very careful with that. And again, if you're not sure if something's healthy, then it probably isn't. So you might want to stay away from that. But again, you can always ask your therapist for guidance on that. Moving on, spiritual exercises can be helpful for some people. So meditation, praying, deep breathing, going outside and enjoying nature. Whether you're in a beautiful mountain scenery or you're like me in Florida and close to the beach, you know, take advantage of what's around you. Attend spiritual or religious services if you find that helpful, or read self-help books that you find inspiring. Next slide. Self-care is very important. It really is important to nurture yourself and pamper yourself every once in a while. So some easy things that you can do would be to take a bubble bath. You know, if you can find, you know, 30 minutes in your day, take the time to slow down, take a bubble bath, listen to your inspirational songs that you have on your iPod playlist. You know, maybe bring a book in there with you. Treat yourself to a spa service. And use your voice. If you're struggling, ask for support. That's a big piece of self-care. It's not just going to the spa. And I like this one, embracing your inner child. So do something that you enjoyed when you were a kid. You know, watch cartoons, go to the park, go to the zoo, go to the animal shelter and play with some of the animals. It can be amazing what mood lifters those can be. And kind of to start wrapping up, really, again, I've said it. This is probably the third time I've said it, but I'll say it again. Recovery does not occur alone or in isolation. So it really, you know, it takes a village. So, you know, the individual certainly needs to pull in family and support systems, support groups, and a treatment team. It's really going to be very important. And I really want everyone to be hopeful. You know, I really hope that no one is giving up. Don't let frustration get the best of you because it can be a very frustrating and challenging time. You know, and I would venture to say that most professionals that work in the eating disorder field would not be in this field if we really didn't believe and know that recovery was possible. And I've seen it happen. I've worked in this field for some time now, and I've seen it happen with my own eyes, and it's an amazing thing. So, you know, people who truly want to get better do get better, can get better. You know, and it may not be an easy road, but it is possible. And there isn't always one correct path. So if you go on to the next slide, you know, I just want to leave you with an idea that the road to recovery is a process. There are twists and curves, and there isn't always an easy start and end point. So even though you may want your road to recovery to look like slide 35, a lot of times it looks more like slide 36, which is kind of this map that has all kinds of stuff going on. There is no clear start. There is no clear end, but it's in there somewhere. And each person has their own path, and it all leads to good stuff at the end. So that concludes the presentation portion.
Would you like to begin the survey at this time?
Yes.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in the survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Our first question today. This session provided me with an understanding of eating disorder relapse prevention and coping skills. If you strongly agree, press star 1. If you agree, press star 2. If you disagree, press star 3. Or if you strongly disagree, press star 4. And we'll pause for just a moment. And again, this session provided me with an understanding of eating disorder relapse prevention and coping skills. If you strongly agree, press star 1. If you agree, press star 2. If you disagree, press star 3. Or if you strongly disagree, press star then 4. We'll pause for just another moment. Our second question today. This session educated me on treatment approaches for individuals who are working through the recovery process. For strongly agree, press star 1. For agree, press star 2. If you disagree, press star 3. Or strongly disagree, press star 4. We'll pause for just a moment. Our third question today. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2 for agree. Star 3 for disagree. And star 4 for strongly disagree. We'll pause for just another moment. And our fourth question today. I would recommend this program to others. Please press star 1 if you agree. Press star 2 if you do not agree. And our final question today. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. If you are an individual with an eating disorder, please press star 1. If you are a family member of someone with an eating disorder, press star 2. If you are a health professional, press star 3. Or for other, press star then 4. We'll pause for just a final moment. And that concludes today's survey. We thank you for your participation. Now we'll move into the question and answer session. If you have a question or comment today, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone phone. For those of you joining us today using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute button is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, to the audience, it is star then 1 if you have a question or comment today. And once again to the audience, it is star then 1 if you have a question or comment. And it appears we have no questions at this time. I would like to turn the conference back over to our presenters.
Thank you so much for attending, and thank you to Melanie for providing such wonderful insights. Again, if you have any specific questions about any of the therapies discussed today, please contact the Eating Disorder Team at Cigna by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please be sure to also mark your calendars for our Eating Disorder Awareness Seminar next month on Tuesday, February 28th at 1 o'clock Eastern Time.
And that concludes today's conference. We thank you all for joining us.